Hey there, oh there, you're listening to Super Tool Shed, the only podcast where fanboy rage is worn like a banana hammock. I'm Bennett the Sage, I'm joined by my fellow compatriot, my brothers-in-arms, as it were, Mark the Engineer, and today we have a special guest here in the shed. It's Lachlan Huddy of Bad Call TV and of General Awesomeness. You might have seen him in our recent t-shirt promo, he was absolutely frightening.
G'day everybody.
This podcast today is going to be centered around, well, a movie that we saw recently, and I think we're all in agreement that we really liked it, and, well, we wish it was doing better right now. But before we get to that, it's Pacific Rim, by the way, but before we get to that, let's have the pleasantries out and about and out of the way. So, Mark, Locke, how you been?
Guest goes first.
I've been really well, just got back from my honeymoon in Europe. So I got a lot of work to catch up on. We had a great time there. I did leave my wedding ring in Sweden. Christian, if you're listening to this, hope you can get that sent back ASAP.
Oh, is that the story you're going with? Oh, I lost it in Sweden.
Yeah, at the orgy.
Which a your
dirty
wife?
Swedish midsummer orgy.
Oh my God! And we're off to a lightning quick start. Just so we're clear.
How have you been, Marcellus?
Oh, funny. Thanks. Tell everybody my real name, why don't you? I already got outed on IMDb. It actually says born Marcellus Sweat, and I'm like, fuck, secret's out. I got
shit.
Yeah, cheese it.
You're still reeling from a childhood where it wasn't cool. And then Pulp Fiction happened, so now it's cool. So you just need to embrace that.
It's the only thing I owe to Tarantino, and I mean the only thing. Not to Ving Rhames, because goddamn him. No.
Go back to that. What do you have against Ving Rhames?
Aquaman.
Continue.
You're going to need to elaborate on that one for me, buddy.
There exists in this world a pilot for Aquaman called Mercy Reef, and Ving Rhames is in it. Find it, Locke. Find it and know that this pain that I've inflicted upon you is because I'm your friend.
How have I not heard about this prior till now? That's amazing.
Because it's sitting in the exact same place as all of those E.T. cartridges.
I see.
And the Clerks television show pilot.
Yeah.
What sort of time period are we looking at
modern,
with this Aquaman pilot?
Like completely modern, but it's Smallville-ized, so it's like that fucking Aquaman's the surf bum, and he finds out that he's the Prince of Atlantis, and a pilot done on such a wheelie bin budget that they didn't even bother with. Like, there's blown takes all over the place. Like, seriously. Where you realize that, like, I know Ving Rhames is a good actor. I know he is. But there's only so much you can do with one take if you're not Calculon. So.
Yeah. But Ving's also, he's an actor very much in the Samuel L. Jackson mold where they don't really say no. You know, they just go to work. And. You know,
it's just Sam Jackson playing Sam Jackson as Sam Jackson in this role.
Getting real shouty.
Yeah. So, but you can tell we haven't done this in a while because we've just been under it and busy, and I've been busy. And really what's happened between the last tool shed and this tool shed is that I've managed to prove that I don't know exactly that much about Superman. Just to bring that up.
Just, everyone is giving you shit about using the Bruce Timm Superman animated universe into the equation.
I got nailed to the wall.
What is there to not know about Superman?
Well, it's that Bruce Timm contemporized the universe for a television audience, and he took a lot of like old concepts, made them new. So my first introduction to Superman was the animated series, and then I kind of worked my way backwards, but only so far. So
how did you avoid the Christopher Reeve movies for that long?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. It's just that when the Christopher Reeve movies happened, I was extremely young, didn't really give too much of a shit about Superman. When Lois and Clark happened, well, that's just a soap opera that happens to have Superman in it. That doesn't really count. So my real, like, love of comic books didn't happen until right around the time that Superman the Animated Series came out, but I was still a Marvel guy at the time. But eventually I worked my way into being a DC person, worked my way backwards, but again, only so far because 70 years of continuity. So this kind of informed my vision of Superman to the point where, because, I mean, you spend so much time in Bruce Timm's universe, you kind of don't know anything else, especially since, you know, everybody complains about comics, nobody complains about Bruce Timm's universe. So this informed my review of Man of Steel, which people just nailed me to the wall for, and rightfully so.
You were mercilessly, like, hammered. Like, first night as a prison bitch hammered.
Yeah, honestly, like, you...
And you didn't beat anybody up.
Seriously, like, you could have just put a tutu on me and scrawled bitch right across my fucking forehead because the audience just nailed me straight to the wall on it. And you know what? I say call me on my bullshit all the time. Do it. I'm happy with that. But it was the only time that we had available to do Toolshed in the last few weeks because we've been just hammering with, like, t-shirt sale and, like, other people need my attention.
And also, I will say that now that the episode's out, Devilman has become my Fitzcarraldo a little bit. It's, the shoot for that was so hellacious that I can't even really properly describe it, but I'll start with this. The ending that eventually wound up in the review was not the ending that I wrote into the script, as Mark can tell you. The original ending was that I burn it, but still have that same kind of somber tone that I went with in the end of the review. But the problems stacked upon themselves when I tried to go out into the woods in a place where we can have a fire pit. First off, I wanted this shot in the evening. But if you wanted to go out in the, like, in the campgrounds, in the woods nearby, and you wanted to be in the evening, and if you wanted it in the evening, you would have to pay for a full night's camping, and that's $60. So,
and
no.
Times are tough. We're in the middle of a recession.
I'm going to pay $60 to spend an hour trying to set up a shot of a fire, basically.
Well, we also like, not to kind of lay it bare, but we're fucking behind schedule. We went from 3 weeks ahead of, yeah, we went to like 3 weeks to three episodes ahead of every single episode that you see to we're doing it now. Like, we're Bill O'Reillying the fuck out of it and we're doing it live. Like, there's no way around it. And we're trying to get back that buffer because we've got a shit ton to do.
But I tried to film that fire twice. Once during the twilight period, and I realized, oh crap, the campgrounds are going to close, and my car is going to be trapped in the camp if I don't skedaddle. So I came back the day after, and I said, well, like, fine, we'll just do it during the day. It won't look as good, but whatever.
Ben, are you legally allowed near fire?
If the lawmakers knew how I am and how I handle danger, they probably would not allow me.
Speaking of fire.
speaking of fire, continuing with the story, we found a great place to have a fire. It was a part of a group campground, and it was disused. And no one was around it. And it had like a walk-up pit. It had like a circle around it. It looked good. It looked like, you know, if you were going to burn something, this is where you would want to burn it. And so building a fire, then all of a sudden, I had my friend Gabe with me. He was, you know, helping out. I looked over to the parking lot, and then a huge white bus started to park itself. And I'm like, oh, God, abort, abort. And, you know, the fire was barely started, but we had to put it out. And out poured, like, a bunch of kids. And I... like, they must have reserved this spot for use.
No, you should have just gone full bore with it and just started, like, dancing around the fire with your shirts off.
And, like, it was just that I was at the end of my rope. I was just so frustrated with this process. And, and then all of a sudden, just a bunch of Jewish kids on a white bus just ruined my day for me. And in that moment, I hated the Jews.
Wow. All right.
In that one moment, like I bared no ill will or hatred toward any one person of religion or creed or sexual orientation. I bared no ill will. But in that one moment, I was fucking Joseph Goebbels. I hated them. I wanted them to die. They were small and I had a fire so I could stoke it. I could just pour them in. It's like, and their parents would have been horrified, but then I wouldn't have cared. It's like, you miserable little fucks, you ruined my shot.
And you know, out of that, let's say 3.5 minute diatribe, what's the pull quote going to be? I hated the Jews. Bennett White, 2013.
Well, here's the thing that, like, I hated, which means I don't know, I don't anymore.
Oh no! Now they're all fine. That's great.
They're all fine. But like in the first, like the 10 minutes after I'm driving away, is like fucking Jews.
Well, it's fine because it resulted in a shot where you throw yet another movie into the water, and as we know in the Bennyverse, everything that gets thrown into the water ends up on back. It just eventually comes back, or it ends up at Locke's doorstep.
Yeah, because that's how that works.
It's El Nino. Everything ends up. Everything ends up down under. I get that though, Ben. I've had those moments. You know, when we're shooting at my house, for example, we live right under a flight path, and so especially at night times, you know, between 7 and 9, when most of the flights are leaving, and I have fantasized about taking a Stinger out onto my back deck and just taking out a plane to make myself feel better and to punish them for ruining my audio. And this seems perfectly reasonable at the time.
It's always perfectly. I don't know what it is about trying to make film, or let's be honest with ourselves. We're not making films here, but it's just something when you're on set trying to get. Yeah, cinema. It's just something about when you're on set, you got your technology out in the open and you just trying to get something done, but you're at the whim of fate, basically. Mm. I mean, like, everyone else's lives are pushing themselves into your workspace, and it just gets you fucking angry. I don't know what it is. It's universal.
I've got both of you fucks beat. I live next to an airport. All right, like anytime I've got to film anything or record anything for either one of you, just like, okay, can't do this during the day. Why? Just like, what the fuck was that, a fan? Yeah, two huge ones that go at about 500 miles an hour
during the day. How many hours of daylight do you see in any given week anyway, Mark?
Shut up. See, that question can be answered by whether or not I'm doing something for you. Because if it's, oh, I gotta hang around for Locke, well then let's see what 4 a.m. looks like.
Hey. I stayed up till 4 a.m. to deliver that beautiful piece of skull fuckery.
Yes, let's see you. Round of applause for Mr. Huddy, because he did deliver. He delivered with almost no notice. Set up lights, tricked his friend into being a gimp on film, which probably will embarrass his parents.
And he is terrified. It would have been perfect
if we found a leather suit. Leather gimp suit.
Or like
really
a mask.
Appreciate Jeff's just kind of looking half seductively and just half serenely at the camera.
Well, he's kicking his legs too, like a 16-year-old girl on the phone.
Yeah, I'm going to take credit for that. That was 100% Lachlan Huddy direction. Yeah, kick your legs. But don't kick your legs too much. You'll agitate the smoke too badly. And then we won't have our ground fog. And I built my little chiller so we'd have ground fog and everything.
Oh my God.
It was a great day. Great day.
I am probably the most proud of the Devil Man video than anything I've ever done, both in terms of how everyone just kind of came together at the last moment, basically. Like, I had the review done by like 4 a.m. and I'm actually kind of embarrassed to say that it didn't render properly, so like the last 15 seconds of the review was cut out, so, and I didn't fix it until like this afternoon.
Yeah, I was about to say, I just got through watching it, and it seemed fun. So.
Yeah, I know, but it shows you how on the ball I am, really. But I just love how everything came together, especially when you realize how much work actually went into it. Yes. And even even the mid T-shirt promo was, I gotta say, like, if I wasn't me and I looked at that T-shirt promo, I would feel scared not to buy one.
I also enjoy how you guys are like putting the deadline on the T-shirts too. I mean, that's just salesmanship 101. That's really going to galvanize people into action, I think.
Okay, that is something that I do want to talk about. All right, we have the FAQs page. If anybody goes and gets cheeky and decides to go to the link beforehand, before the T-shirt sale starts, pretty much the brass tacks of it is that, like, we are all still, like, in the midst of doing what it is that we do, and we're kind of taking a break and doing this T-shirt sale, which we don't have an army of people to do it. So, like, that means that, like, all the orders are processed by hand. They're all driven to the post by me, like, all of it. So the reason why it is that we have this limited time sale, which it was Bennett's idea to do it for about 48 to 72 hours, because I would have just as easily said 24 hours is enough, because that's what T-Fury does, and that's what Ripped Apparel does, and a bunch of other 24-hour, you know, limited edition shirt sites. But he wants to make sure that, you know, like, just in case there's some guy at the 11th hour on a Sunday that can get that done and make his order, fine, make the order. Okay. The reason why it is that we're not going with any of the pre-printed ones where you can, you know, pay $24.95 is because we don't want to charge people $24.95 for a shirt that costs, you know, X amount to make. It's like, T-shirt production is not that expensive. Like, for a full color, 4 to 5 color shirt, you're not looking at any more than, like, maybe $12. So we're just trying to, like, do something simple, something monochrome, something fun, that isn't going to break anybody's wallet.
And it's good, and it works, and it looks, the design's good, the color scheme's good, you know.
The color scheme, white on black.
You can scoff, but it's a winning combination, man.
Yeah, effective monochrome feeling design works, I think.
I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying the color scheme, when you're just using two colors, actually one no color and one just sort of every other color combined is...
Well, I mean, technically speaking, neither of them are colors, really, aren't they? They're shades.
I mean,
get all highfalutin and artistic here.
No. This podcast is very famous for its pedantry.
So, that said, yes, there is going to be a T-shirt sale. It's going to be July 19th through the 21st. It's this upcoming weekend. Shirts are $12. Shipping is $5.95. If you're a fatty, then they're $14 because that's...
Oh,
what
God. Hey.
What? What, fatty?
Let's not be mean about it. Hey, I'm an XL, okay? So I don't have to subject myself to the fat tax yet.
What's that, Ben? I can't hear you with that mouth full of chips.
Yeah, let's just break this down right now. What shirt size are you, Locke?
Well, I'm I grew up in a city that had a lot of lead in the atmosphere, so it may have affected my growth. So I would be a small men's or a large child's, I suppose.
What are you, Prince?
If only I were that talented.
110 pounds of all man.
Yeah. No, I think Prince and I probably would clock in at about the same height.
Oh, here's what I thought, that your partner in arms was just tall, but no, you're Paul Simon to his Art Garfunkel.
Yeah, actually, Darcy is quite a short fellow as well.
Yes,
I just surround myself with short people. My wife used to be a jockey, which works out very well for me.
Oh God, you're Steven Seagaling it, basically. If you watch any Steven Seagal film, you realize that everyone and everything around him is artificially lowered so he could appear bigger.
Yeah. That's, well, I mean, the dude knows what he's about. The dude knows what he's doing.
And I would just for a second like to have a moment of silent respect for Renee Huddy for being the best trooper in the history of new media.
She is a trooper, isn't she? She's lovely.
She was the one who you told me before we recorded. She was the one who did your makeup for the T-shirt promo.
Yes. She's a real Renaissance lady, my sweetheart. She does the makeup. Quite a good artist. Not a bad little actress. So yeah, I exploit her mercilessly wherever I can.
She is your wife, and what are wives for if not to exploit them?
That's right. Well, you know, and once married, ladies, as Jerry Falwell says, you have accepted the headship of a man, and and I think there's something in that for everybody,
especially for Jerry Falwell's wife.
All right, what are we talking about this episode?
Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
A spectacular slice of cinema.
It is.
Which, Locke, you got to see it first, didn't you? Because we got it late.
Yes. They seem to be doing that a lot now, doing the international release before the domestic release for American films. So this was yet another one. I went to see it the night it came out. That was actually the day we got back. So I was horribly jet lagged. But you better believe that's not going to stop me watching Pacific Rim. Because this, for me, I don't know how you guys felt, but for me, this was like the movie for this year. You know, this is what I'd really been hanging out for.
I would say that we were all looking forward to this movie. Outside of outside of Mark's weirdness of having two pilots in the robot, like for some reason, that's like your Appalachia or something. Like you just can't get beyond that.
I think they had a. I'm not going to say that their reasoning for it was bulletproof. It was really good, which they extended because they kind of backfed that into like, oh, well, dinosaurs had two brains, a primary brain and a subbrain, which is why it is that it takes two pilots to pilot this huge piece of machinery. And
well, I don't know. It was fairly vague. They said the neural load was too great.
Well, there was a line about how kaiju have two brains, and you can kind of extrapolate that as to, okay, that makes sense that, you know, the neural load of controlling something, you know, so much larger than you in terms of relative scale. It's like, okay, one brain can't handle that, I guess. So one person acts as the left half of the brain and the other person acts as the right half. And like, but still, I just kind of think that my original complaint was that it's kind of bullshit. The idea of having two pilots, like, and really they didn't even commit to that just because, you know, your main guy gets his one like badass moment in the beginning of the film where it's like, he's the only guy who's ever managed to pilot what, like be a single alone pilot and get it to shore.
Not the only fella, Idris Elba. Idris Elba's character managed that as well.
Yeah.
That was...
To great...
That was... They had their little bro moment because they were the only two who'd ever solo piloted before.
All right. So before we really kick the gears on this, massive spoilers all over this episode. If you haven't seen Pacific Rim yet, one, you're the problem and you're probably the reason why it is that I won't get another Dread film, so go fucking say it!
Yes, and may I interject also, we really need Guillermo's movie to do well because I need that At the Mountains of Madness to be produced. And if this thing doesn't make a shitload of money, I just don't think there's any chance of that. So let's make this happen, people. Team effort, hands in, hoorah. Let's do it.
There you go.
Go team! Well, yay, capitalism.
The good news is that it's already made more money than Dread.
Bad part. The bad thing is... It costs way, way more to make than Dread.
Yeah, there's that.
But you do see the money on screen. Sometimes with these blockbusters, you don't. But this one, I think we can all agree, you see that money on screen.
Well, technically speaking, a lot of the money you do see on screen with most Hollywood films, it's just that the money is spent on the actors.
Yeah, which they really did pack this movie with wall-to-wall nobody. Did you notice that?
Yeah, actually, it's, you know that you are watching a film with nobodies if the opening scene involves two brothers, one of them is killed, and you're not sure which one. Like, I'm thinking to myself, okay, They look alike. They sound alike. And one of them is the narrator, but I can't figure out who's who.
I'm gonna pull you up there, Ben, because I'm a big fan of Sons of Anarchy, fans of that show are gonna be very familiar with Charlie Hunnam. I also enjoy, if you notice, Charlie has a way of walking. He can't walk. He swaggers everywhere.
Yeah, no, he walks. And he was definitely chaps.
Yeah, well, that's exactly, and that's very much a holdover from his character in Sons of Anarchy, I think. I also enjoyed how they made Gypsy Danger kind of swagger like that too.
That it was just like very heavy on the heavy in the step, like heavy in the knee, so the whole shoulder would come down every time it took a step.
Exactly. Well, it was meant to emulate John Wayne's walk, actually.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they wanted to. Each one of the Jaegers was meant to reflect the culture which produced it. Obviously.
Which completely explains the Chinese robot and that third vestigial carnival freak show arm. In
that. It's the Chinese knockoff Jaeger.
I know, right? And that thing got axed at the drop of a hat. I thought these guys were supposed to be the ultimate badasses.
It's like thundercloud formation, and then just like a bitch. Just completely ripped in half.
Just arms torn off. Just, oh my God. And you know, God bless the Russian Jaeger for being, for looking like it came from a place where they just stole all the money to build it in the first place.
You can actually look, if you look closely, I bet you could see like tank treads, like used as like mesh between the joints.
Yeah. And the head intended to look like a missile silo.
Yeah.
Too. Well, that's really, really subtle, guys. It's nice.
Their Jaeger was just, I mean, you see it, and like the whole audience that I was with, which unfortunately it did not pack the house, Pacific Rim. I don't think it's packed the house anywhere. But the whole audience was just kind of like on board with this really dumpy looking fucking robot. Where this robot's making Gigantor look awesome, you know, and you're like, oh my God, Russia.
And the pilots, I mean, could you imagine a more Russian pair
That's the thing with this movie. Like, the whole movie stereotypes its characters to an almost cartoonish level.
It's G Gundam, the movie.
And yeah, exactly. It's G Gundam, the movie. Like, the Chinese pilots are acrobats, of course. The fucking Russian pilots are like bleached,
and they're triplets, so you really can't tell them apart, you know.
Oh
God! And of course, like the Russian pilots are probably wearing tracksuits. And
the one thing that they didn't go for was Russians in tracksuits. They were in full military garb. They weren't like dressed.
Those pilot suits for the Russians were modeled on Cosmonaut. You know, suits from the 70s, 60s, 70s.
Seriously, every single white guy in that movie was blonde and ripped.
But wait, it gets better because of all the references and of all the little nods to what military history has done for each particular country. Australia got the worst rub, didn't they, Locke?
Indeed. I don't understand why they can't cast Australian actors.
Hold on, wait. Lay down your Australian cred, please.
Okay, well, I was conceived in the state of South Australia, so that's right. You've got that right there. After that, we moved to a small mining town in the state of Queensland called Mount Isa. Now, this sits right on the edge of the desert. So when you think about outback, okay, that's where I grew up. Red dirt, Spinifex, kangaroos on the side of the road. My childhood was the classic Australia.
And Mad Max is driving out in the desert trying to look for gasoline.
That's right. But it costs too much out there now, so even Max can't get me. So you know, I live in Brisbane. So I've done it all. I've done city Australia, coastal Australia, and inland outback Australia. Okay, so that's my Australia cred.
So what is your opinion on the actors portraying your native homeland?
Uh, I thought I really like both those characters for various reasons. I enjoy the fact they weren't afraid to make them very broad. I thought the dad. I can't remember either of their names because, because who has the time? That's probably Steve-O and
Bruce.
And their mother's name, you know, the wife and mother's name would have been Beryl or something like that.
All they were missing was those dangling cork hats.
Yeah. But I actually thought the father was an Australian actor, so I couldn't understand why he was mangling the accent so badly. But then I looked him up and no, he's actually an American. That actor was American. The one who played his son was a Brit. And I did get the impression while listening to him speak that he was a Brit trying to do an Australian accent. So, I mean, I think the performances were good. I just think the accents were quite bad. But I don't blame him for that. The Australian accent's a very difficult one to pull off. It's very nuanced. And to an outsider, it sounds, almost indistinguishable from certain kinds of British accents. So, I don't blame him. But I just think no Australian actors stay in Australia. They're all in L.A., so I'm sure you could have found a couple of Australian dudes. Yeah, probably. Try a bit harder.
I love the fact that the father looks about the same age as his son.
Just a little more chiseled.
Just, like some crow's feet around his eyes, and then bam, he's older. Now, I don't think he even had salt and pepper hair because they're both blonde. So, like, what? Did he have him when he was 10?
Well,
I found it really interesting that when they're like describing all the Jaegers, that it's like, and Australia's got the best one.
How?
Yeah, I like that. I like, well, you know.
It's Australia.
Well, it's the rift opened in the Pacific. So, like, we would have, we're right there. We're smack in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah,
we
so
would
that
need
means
to
you fucks
scramble.
Would have got knocked first.
Actually, don't you just love the first? Don't you just love the fact that the rift, the portal, that these giant aliens are pouring into our world, forcing their way into our world, is just within spitting distance of China. Seriously, they walk there. They walk to the rift, and yet what is the first place they attack? San Francisco. An ocean length away, they had China literally in their back door. They had the back door to China. What did they attack first? Fucking San Francisco.
Because you don't fuck with a landlord, that's why. Have you started learning Chinese yet, Bennett? I have.
you can kind of imagine that kaiju, though. Because they probably had him programmed, all right, yes, China is the closest, hit that. And then he just kind of passes through the rift and then hangs a hard right. And those aliens were sitting there going, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, man, we got to work on this technology. It is incomplete.
incomplete after 65 fucking million years.
Like, oh, they're still coming out retarded. I don't understand.
What? Like, this theory obviously disproves evolution. I mean, if these aliens have existed for 65 million years, going from planet to planet to planet to planet to planet to planet to planet, depleting these resources and moving on, pretty soon they're just going to run out of planets.
You know what this movie was missing, though? Will Smith.
What?
Tell me it's not that. Independence Day. Tell me this whole fucking movie isn't Independence Day with giant robots.
Especially the
ending.
Especially the ending. It's very, very Independence Day-like. But you know what? That is fine. Because there is a sense of optimism in Independence Day that just doesn't exist in today's blockbusters.
Yeah, that's true. Everything's gotten so heavy. And this one was so willfully kind of lighthearted, even when people were sacrificing themselves in nuclear blasts for the cause.
Because, you know what? Like,
I enjoyed that.
There was a scene, like the scene where... Mako. Was just like as a little girl crying, running away from a gigantic monster that probably killed her parents and killed everyone she ever loved. But who stops them? Idris Elba in a pilot suit. And how is he framed? With the sun as his halo, with triumphant choral music in the background. That was the most beautiful shot I have ever seen in a summer blockbuster movie this year. Tell me
and
that
the
wasn't
look
the money
he tips
shot.
Her. It was gorgeous. And that look he tips her, just like You're welcome, sweetheart.
That man was Superman. That Idris Elba, you are the Black Superman. Thank you.
I would follow him into hell. I know that a lot of people probably groaned when he did his speech and then hit us with tonight we're canceling the apocalypse. But I unashamedly say I got chills.
It was a really good speech, but it was by that point that, like,
that you just no, that was like Bill Paxton.
Exactly. Saying, like, it's like tonight we're canceling the apocalypse, and I'm like, today is our Independence Day.
I never really get sick of the rallying the troops speech. I think everyone is trying to be Braveheart now, and no one's ever topped it. But I think some people have come close, and for me, that speech came close. That and I thought Aragorn's speech at the end of Lord of the Rings was quite good, too.
But it is not this day.
It is not this day.
Like, it's
like no, it's fucking not.
Idris Elba that sells it, though. I think it's less about the words of the speech.
Yes, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
More about the actors absolutely. Selling it. Like Elba just knows how to make you sit in your fucking chair and pay attention.
Yeah.
Like, whether he's
even when
in Heimdall or Luther or whatever, he like whenever he's on screen, you just like whatever you're doing, you just kind of stop and go, shh, Idris is talking.
Stop. And the thing is, even when he's got some not great dialogue, and let's be honest, there were some howlers in Pacific Rim.
There was some bad
shit. Idris just sells.
Do you have any idea how happy I was that Guillermo del Toro was like, no, just be you on screen, please. I saw Prometheus. You were really bad in it.
Can I just quickly chime in here with Idris Elba as Heimdall was one of the more distracting casting decisions because I understand he's a great actor and he belonged in that movie, but why do you cast him in the role where he is completely separated from all the white people? It's like, yeah, we got a Black Norse god, but we don't like seeing him. He's guarding this rainbow bridge that no one uses. We put him in the back. We don't want to see him.
We don't talk about war.
He just stands there and be quiet like they're supposed to.
I was discussing this Pacific Rim with one of my friends, and we had this great idea that would have made the movie 10 times better. If when they were doing the rundown of all the Jaegers, wouldn't it be funny if every, you know, how every, since they're stereotyping nations anyway, wouldn't it be great if they tried to, like, explain how each Jaeger is powered? So, like, the Chinese robot is actually man-powered. There's a bunch of slaves just turning gears.
Oh, my God. I mean, they tried to do that. They tried because they had to make Gypsy Danger, like, the one thing that could withstand an EMP for some, which... I call bullshit on the EMP. Call total bullshit on the EMP. Because, like, oh, Gypsy Danger's analog. Bullshit!
It's nuclear powered. Like, what do you think that controls that? Coal?
Yeah.
Like, nuclear power.
Yeah, and what kind of power does it generate? I'm fairly sure it's generating electrical power from the nuclear.
No, that light, that wonderful halo of light you see around them, that's nuclear.
That's just pure nuclear burn. There you go. I mean, but you gotta take that. You gotta give them that too. You gotta give them a lot of things because let's be honest. To ensure that there's actual tension in this film, they have to have the pilots actually inside these gigantic mechs. And seriously, at our point in technology right now, we have remote piloted drones. There's no way they'd be in the Jaegers, they'd be piloting them remotely. But, you know, that makes a shit movie, so you just got to give them that.
Yeah, because, I mean, they've done that in Gundam before, where that was the whole, like, second part of Gundam Wing, the idea that the new type pilot can be outdone by the Zero system, which is supposed to make the new type pilot better all by itself.
Like, but didn't they already make that movie in stealth?
Yeah, they really did.
And then it went horribly wrong.
Wrong.
But yeah, like, that's the whole second half of Gundam Wing, where, like, they have, like, okay, here's the new type pilot in the Zero system. The Zero system makes the new type pilot better, but what if we just remove the human element from the Zero system? Now we have the Mercury S and the V8, and they don't need fucking pilots. They're entirely computer-controlled. And then, of course, you know, new type pilots.
No, I think they could have still had the pilots. It's just the pilots would have been in a room somewhere, you know, with, like, a mouse and a keyboard
and making a coffee. This happen. Well, I still just, when the EMP happened, because at this point I think that as a sci-fi fan you always know what's going to happen when there's some big expensive piece of kit just flying around on screen. It's like there's going to be an EMP in like 50 seconds. And when it happens and they're talking about like, oh no, like a Gypsy Danger is completely analog. No, it fucking isn't. It has lights, it has buttons, it has a control system, which is all electrical, and I don't care how much fucking shielding you have for radiation, it's shielding around the fucking core. That's what they set up, is that, oh, well, the reason why Idris's character is all fucked up is because he's got radiation poisoning. Okay, so that means they shielded the core. Or at least the cockpit, not the whole fucking thing. What the fuck,
Mark,
was that?
You're starting to sound like you don't like this movie.
No, I love this movie. Shut up.
Shut up.
You shut I your thought, fucking you know, whore mouth.
For me, though, it was the exact opposite of what I got when I was watching Man of Steel. When I was watching Man of Steel, I'm like, this needs less action. You know, I'm like, I'm sick of the Kryptonians beating on one another. You know, let's just bring it back to the human drama that you've been so desperately trying to cultivate. But with Pacific Rim, the action scenes were so good, and that CGI was just incredible. I just wanted more. I wanted more mech brawls.
Everything felt like it had weight. You know, there was no objects in space problem, which I thought was really impressive. I thought that the whole like dragging the huge ass tanker ship and using it as a baseball bat was kind of funny.
Oh yeah, especially when they have a sword. They have a sword, yet they carry this huge steamliner because probably indispensable to the economy, this fragile economy that's totally based off the Jaegers. Let's just drag it up and beat up a motherfucker with the ship. But let's face facts. When that kaiju spread its wings open and starts flying with the Jaeger up into the upper stratosphere, that was a holy shit moment. I forgot that movies can have those kinds of moments.
Yeah, it really they described that as the Swiss Army knife of the kaijus, because it could just do everything.
And that was genuinely impressive when the sword comes out, but everybody that left the theater was kind of saying the same thing, which is the sword was bullshit.
Why didn't you lead with that?
Like, why didn't you lead with that? The sword was bullshit. You pulled that out of your ass. Why the fuck would you have a sword built into the arm? Why wouldn't you just have a knife? Because, you know, by this point, most people have played fucking Armored Core. So in Armored Core, you don't have knives just hidden places. It's like, okay, I want my mech to be, you know, melee specific. Well, then you get this big fucking knife.
It's not like the knife in Avatar where that gigantic ED-209 that the colonel was piloting just has like a 5-foot knife it has. Like, it just has a 5-foot knife.
But doesn't it make more sense, though, to just have the knife as a piece of equipment as opposed to this bullshit Ivy Valentine chain sword that just comes out of the arm conveniently?
Well, I mean, you could make the argument that sometimes the mech's going to need to be able to grab onto things when you've got a big fucking sword in the way. That's not going to make that very easy.
I'm not saying a sword. It's like the equivalent of, you know, like a Bowie knife that it could keep, you know, strapped to its side or something. Just like, or like across the chest, you know, something, anything. Not this thing that was specifically meant to make the audience pop and all it did was make them laugh.
The thing that made me laugh about that, because I don't mind the sword, I think it looked cool enough to justify its present in the film, and that's all I really need for this kind of movie. But the fact that Riley needed to be told about the sword, like, seriously?
Yeah, because after they pull it out the first time, they won't stop fucking using it. Like, oh, yeah, well, let's just use it all the time now. It's like,
yeah,
where was
exactly.
it before? So, where was it against that the Iceman thing?
Yeah, but I mean, it was a great moment when he gutted that kaiju from, you know, throat to tail. That was pretty cool. Have to wonder why it kept obligingly swimming along, though, don't you?
It was like, oh, this hurts. Better keep going.
Maybe if I keep going, it'll stop.
I guess that's supposed to be momentum. Like, I can't stop it now. It's too late.
All right, warrior.
I think that my favorite thing in the movie in terms of like characters is Ron Perlman.
Of course, he's Ron. Now, did everyone stay for the end for the post credits?
I fucking did.
You know, you did.
Yeah,
I knew something was coming. I knew so. I just had to. And when he crawled out of there, that was a wonderful moment.
Because I just knew that he wasn't dead. Because it's like, come on, he didn't even really like chomp down on him hard or anything.
I'm just kind of tired of Ron Perlman dying anyway. I mean, is there a film outside of the Hellboy franchise where he hasn't bitten the dust?
Fuck no.
Yeah, it's just what Ron does.
I was gonna say Alien Resurrection, but then I'm like, no, he dies in that.
It's you might as well try to find a movie where Sean Bean doesn't die.
Yeah, isn't that?
That's true. But I think that Ron Perlman just added like a dimension of Bruce Campbell like comedy to.
I enjoyed the fact that Ron Perlman's character was kind of like the comedy relief to the comedy relief.
Yeah,
you know, he was that.
Oh, that motherfucker! That little shit stain of a. Fucking that J.J. Abrams looking motherfucker.
I know, he looks just like J.J. Abrams, doesn't he?
And he sounds like fucking Bobcat Goldthwait. I hated that guy. I hate that guy too. He's on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and it's the most distracting thing I've ever seen in my life because I know that voice. I know that guy. And every time he's on screen, I just kept thinking to myself, does your Jaeger make too much noise? Try Jaeger Bagers.
Oh my god. Yeah, I didn't know what he's from because being from Philadelphia, I don't take any pride in Philadelphia because this place is fucking circling the toilet, so I don't really want to watch a show about the fucking flappy-headed morons that populate the city that I live in.
I'm gonna devil's advocate it, though, and say Charlie Day and that dude from Torchwood, I don't know what the actor's name is, but their little crazy scientist shtick together was one of my favorite parts of the film. I think they were great.
I thought it was a little bit overplayed on the part of the scientists. You know, like numbers are the closest thing we have to God. It's like,
but that's where this movie kind of works because it takes every character, it goes to the stereotype extreme. Like the guy from Torchwood. You know, he's sort of like this mincing, can't really talk to people, like. He can't, has no social skills whatsoever, kind of scientist, is just completely obsessed. And then you got the weird Jeff Goldblum scientist character from Independence Day. Then we keep going back to that.
And they're both very manic too. You know, you usually have a straight man and, you know, the funny guy, but they're just both just kind of smashing into each other.
So it's basically if Sherlock Holmes from the Sherlock Holmes films was actually partnered up with like a rural, like an alternate universe version of him instead of a Dr. Watson.
Yeah, and I really like that. I like a film that's not afraid to go right over the top, you know?
As good as that is for the soul, though, I just kind of felt I looked at the two of them and I went, all right, so the guy who thinks that numbers are God is wrong, that the manic guy is going to have some epiphany that means that he's going to be right. You know, because that's the way that these Independence Day style movies always go, is that the guy who sounds the smartest is the guy who's always wrong, and then the guy who's
one more time.
the guy who's just like really spastic is always the guy that's like comes up with the answer. You know, you're Jeff Goldblum. Like he's the one that says that like it's always the smart sounding guy that goes like missiles are the answer, but it's the spastic guy that says missiles won't solve anything because they have shields, but I know a way to get around their shields with this stupid virus. All we need is the pilot crazy enough to get us to the mothership, you know.
Yeah, so I suppose you're right. It is God, yeah. Actually, the more we talk about it, just the more and more it becomes Independence Day, doesn't it?
Yes.
and you know what? That's fine.
Right down the last shot, though. I mean, the last shot where Gypsy Danger is just floating there and the aliens are staring down their demise like, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
And right before the explosion happened, I seem to remember the sound. Like, that's... Like, if Gypsy Danger would have laughed like that, I would have been like, well done, Guillermo. Well done.
Circle complete.
Yes. But I dig it. I mean, like, for all these problems that I have with the movie, I still dig the movie a lot. I'll gladly buy it on DVD.
I do too. I will say I certainly hyped it up too much in my mind. I do expect a little bit more from my Del Toro, because I think this is certainly his broadest, most juvenile film, I think. Oh, yeah. Even when you factor in Mimic. So I was thinking there might have been actually a little bit more character drama.
Wait. Guillermo del Toro did Mimic?
Yes, it was his first studio feature, I believe. First Hollywood studio feature.
Jesus Christ, talk about a blast from the past. I haven't thought about that movie since I first saw it back in, 98?
Actually, also, hang on. I'm just going to throw a little known fact about Mimic in here. Now, have we all seen a 90s creature feature called The Relic? It's set in the New York Museum of Natural History.
I'm always confusing the two.
Yeah, okay. So, you're always confusing the two because those two films feature a lot of the same characters because they're actually part of a book series about Margot, who was the woman who works at the Natural History Museum. So, there you go. And this poor woman who apparently keeps coming up against, really freakish shit that you just wouldn't believe in the city of New York.
Which, if you ever go to New York, bunch of freakish shit that you wouldn't believe.
Speaking of New York, don't you find it odd that this is a huge disaster film? I mean, like, buildings are completely being destroyed, like, civilization's kind of hanging on by a thread, and yet, because of the location of the attacks, they're only happening on the Pacific Rim, hence the title. This is a disaster film where New York City is all right.
Which, yes, and does that ever really happen? It is also a disaster film where apparently the only city in Australia that anyone's any interested in destroying is Sydney. I mean,
well, it's the only place that's actually there. I mean, really.
And as soon as it came on and the creature wandered in, and of course the place where it breaches happens to be right in front of the Sydney Opera House. Of course, right?
Well, that's where they're going to build the wall, right there, at the most important monument in Sydney.
What is the first scene in the movie? Golden Gate Bridge, just completely wiped out.
Yeah, just getting taken down.
Just completely taken down. But you think, like, on the cutting room floor, there's, like, scenes of, like, a rural village in Chile getting the shit kicked out of them? Hills.
Like, I get that it's supposed to be about stuff that you recognize, but there does come a point when you do realize, like, you have to, you know, sit down and tell people, like, you know, other places in the world exist. I wouldn't mind seeing Philadelphia destroyed, even though I'm seeing it destroyed in every other movie because it's cheap to film here, and then they just call it someplace else.
Well, all big cities look alike except for the monuments.
Mm.
I want to... As an Australian, in Pacific Rim 2, if we get one, I just want to see a kaiju, like, stagger up to Ayers Rock and then just smack it once and then die of thirst because it's taken so long to get there.
Like a kaiju said, oh, there's got to be a big city on this island somewhere. You know, cut to, like, 10,000 years later, primitive man approaches this kaiju corpse and it thinks it's a god. Here, are you listening, Del Toro? I'm giving you sequel ideas.
Yeah, here's my sequel idea. Megas XLR.
Ugh. What is it with you and wanting the Megas movie?
I want a Megas because there is nothing more earnest than a show about a guy from Jersey who just gets a giant robot and then has to take up the responsibility of being its pilot and defending the Earth. Forget all of your fucking pious, like we defend the Earth because we love the Earth. No, just give me a dude who's as honest as, like, Booster Gold, or as honest as you or me. Just, what would you do with a giant robot? Of course you would fuck around with it right up until the point where somebody's threatening your personal convenience store. Like, that's where I get my beer from. Oh, man, fucking start the fucking mech. You know, like, that's... I think that there was always something so beautiful and honest about a loud, fat dude from Jersey with a giant robot with a slightly misanthropic, chick-hungry friend, and tell me you wouldn't, you know, tell me that that scenario isn't the most likely scenario about like giant robots.
Your pristine, uncynical view of the human race is truly inspiring, Mark.
Okay, fine, smart guy. What would you do if you happened upon a giant robot? Would you just report it, or would you hide it and then keep it and fuck around with it?
Where the fuck would I hide it? It's a giant robot. You think I
you're live in Australia? You live in Australia. There's stretches of land that no man has ever spoken about, let alone set foot on.
Yeah, you have plenty of space to hide a giant robot.
I'm just leaving my multi-billion-dollar mech out to the elements there. It would take me 3 weeks to oil the joints.
Come on, man. It's meant to take... Let's just make it as realistic as possible. It's a mech that can easily take depleted uranium shells straight to the head. Nothing bad happens. And they just leave it there. And you have the know-how to rebuild it. It's in slight disrepair, but you decide over the course of a couple of years that you're going to rebuild it. Are you really going to report it, or are you just going to keep it and fuck with it?
No, I'm going to keep it and fuck with it. But let me... But also, I'd like to reinvent myself as kind of a planet-saving superhero. Problem is, though, what are you saving
exactly.
the planet from?
Exactly. Like, you're going to fly over to Wall Street's like, you better be responsible or else. That's like the biggest threat against the world right now.
No,
so.
Here's what you do. Ask Darce what he would do with a giant robot.
I can tell you here and now, okay? I tell you here and now, he would give me a two-word response, and it would be rad. or you know, if he was feeling particularly lyrical, he'd go, be a rad cunt.
Seriously, like if there is any archetype for the common man in this thing that we call the human race, it is Darce Lorde, where I would trust him in answering that question truthfully, that like, Darce, I'm going to give you a giant robot. Its maintenance will be taken care of. It will cost you nothing to run. What would you do with it? and if his answer is be a rad cunt, awesome. That's the answer I'm looking for. Here's the keys.
And that is what he'd do. And the thing is, Dust doesn't really have an evil bone in his body too. Because so though you might not be able to count on him to really rise to the occasion when you need to, you can also count on him not to, you know, get all despotic and try to take shit over. So, I mean, you could do worse for your mech pilots.
There we go. See, that's what I'm looking for. That's why I want a Megas XLR movie, because Megas XLR represents people like Darce, where it's not the pious pilot, it's not the save the Earth, because that's what you do when you're the superhero. It's just... A God's honest, just fucking nice, stupid guy with a weapon of mass destruction, and he does exactly what you know someone would do with it. Unless, of course, they're fucked in the head, at which point they are going to try and risk their lives and do a bunch of shit. You know, like, they don't have to go through some personal character arc, because they're just built that way, but most people aren't built that way. They're just going to build a giant robot because it's a rad thing to have, and then fuck with it right up until trouble happens, and then maybe they'll rise to the occasion.
Maybe.
Can we talk about the character arcs in Pacific Rim for a second, though?
Oh.
Or lack thereof. What I enjoyed is Charlie Hunnam's character arc seemed to consist of his brother dies, he's in his head while his brother dies, so he's pretty fucked up about that. He doesn't want to go back to piloting the mech, and it takes Idris Elba one line to change his mind.
One hokey-ass line.
And that's pretty much it.
On the wall or in a Jaeger?
which admittedly would convince me. I'd be like, you know, you got a good point there, son.
It's a line that you know that echoes, you know, do you want to die on your feet or on your knees? Mm. And I understood that's what he was trying to say, but he should have just said that. You know, would you want to die on your knees at the rubble of the wall, or do you want to die on your feet of a giant robot? You know,
yeah. Oh, God, I never thought of it like that, Idris Elba. Please lead me to this magical place where I can fight aliens and giant robots. Why did I even think of leaving?
And then there's Marco, And she has obviously quite a bit of trauma, which, precipitates her almost trashing, the entire home base when she gets lost in the drift, I think they call that.
Oh, she's chasing the rabbit.
Yeah. She's chasing the rabbit.
I want to interrupt this just for a moment. Can we talk for a moment about who the fuck comes up with the nomenclature in this movie? I love how the fact that there's the monsters entering the rift, immediately when they do, they're given a nickname. It's like, oh my god, we got a cat four coming through the drift. It's nicknamed Leatherhead. Why do we care what we nicknamed it?
Yeah, I suppose, but that's a standard military thing. This happens all the time. So
yeah,
I can go along with that because that seems to be a real world practice.
that's a real world practice, but that's kind of like the practice of the guys who are like boots on the ground, not like I guess it's something like that's supposed to make it so that they don't seem as scary. Like let's give them stupid names. Like this one's Charlie, you know.
Yeah.
But, also, who came up with calling them kaijus? Like, did someone like in the Pentagon just like, you know what? I read about Japanese mythology, and they have this, they call it kaijus, and it means beast in Japanese. And why don't we call them kaijus? And then they just slapped them right out of the office. They just slapped them right out of the office. Probably, and then followed by the other guy who's decided to call the gigantic robots Jaegers.
It's like I saw this really great show called Zoids once, and the main character, Big Cloud, had this one transformation of his giant robot called the Lacker Zero Jaeger. Let's call him Jaegers.
Also, unfortunately for the American market, when you hear Jaeger, it's almost always followed by either Bonn or Meister.
Well, I'm not going to lie. That's pretty much the only thought I had when the title card came up at the start there.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a person who's specifically responsible for making up the nomenclature for these movies, like the drift. It's like, oh god, do we need to have this stupid fucking name? Can't we just call it a connection or dial up or something? Anything?
Yeah, I'm kind of vague on where drift originates from and how exactly that ties into this idea of a connection.
Yeah,
because I certainly don't go into it. It's really this is the last 20 years in, 2 minutes of voiceover and a few choice images.
Yeah, with really bad voiceover, I might add.
Is there any such thing as good? Like, there's been one good voiceover, and that was Shawshank Redemption, and I don't think anyone's ever done in any movie that had worthwhile voiceover.
Well, who is the dude playing the guy who pilots Gypsy Danger? What's his name again?
Charlie Hunnam.
Yeah, I don't like him.
Yeah, he's a charisma vacuum, really.
He really is. Like, he just... First off, I've never heard anybody who talks like that, ever.
Because he's a Brit, and he's putting on an American accent.
And doing a bad job of it, too.
Like, I mean, we're talking about, like, the entirety of American cinema has been taken over by Brits. Everywhere you turn, there's a British actor playing an American, and they're doing it about 95% well. But this guy is just, like, on the other side of what the shit are you trying to do? Because I don't know if he's trying to sound cool. I don't know if he's trying to be Clint Eastwood. I don't know. Like, how does this dude read lines in a way where I can't visibly see the stick up his ass?
Like, he has, like, almost no presence in the movie. And, again, I can't...
Well,
maybe that was a conscientious decision on Del Toro. He didn't want the characters to basically outshine the duels. Like the monster fights, which admittedly is the real reason we all came to see this movie. I mean, we didn't want exactly a character piece. We didn't want to come here for the human drama. We came here to see giant robots.
Well, the hook is giant robots. But the thing is that in every piece of giant robot, media that exists, the other, like the line that's tied around the hook is the pilots. So you're always going to spend time with those pilots because the pilots are what humanize the otherwise, mechanical giant robots. So when you stick this guy in front of me and he's just talking like this and we had a connection, can't you feel it? Don't you understand? Come on.
Look, I lay a lot of that at the feet of the script, and I think Arali especially suffered from the same problem that a lot of lead characters and leading men, especially in Hollywood, suffer from, is that he's probably the least interesting character in the movie, you know, because they have to have their arc and they have to grow, so they by necessity have to start out less interesting than they're going to be at the end. You know what I mean? And but to get back to what
main
Ben
characters
said,
start
also
off broken, and then they by the end of the movie they're fixed.
Exactly, but that's a script thing too. He just seemed to be fixed far too quickly and far too easily. He had the death of his brother is supposed to be the shadow that's hanging over the whole film, and it's cleared up by the start of the second act.
It's never brought up or mentioned again. Same thing with Mako's initial
family,
Mako's initial.
Yeah, they
kind of
swept that right under the rug because it's like it's about revenge. We don't even see her family die. She's just like traumatized by a kaiju attack, but we don't really go, you know, backwards and be like, oh God, you know, like she was playing outside and then this kaiju just crushed her fucking house, you know?
But getting back to what Ben said about it being a conscious choice of Del Toro's part, I'm pretty sure that it was. I read that he, after the original rough cut, he edited out about an hour's worth of footage. And pretty much all of that was character stuff because he said, you know, I don't want to cut the jewels down because this is, you know, this is what people are coming here for. And he said, I also can't pretend, you know, I'm making a, you know, this deep rumination on the human condition. So every character's arc was edited down to its absolute bare bones. Movie did suffer. Well, it was fine by me because I still got what I wanted in the mech battles, but I did think the movie suffered a little. I certainly wasn't as engaged as I could be.
Well, if they had just if they just found their focus, well, first off, if it didn't have to be two fucking pilots per mech, if they could have found their focus in the formula of Top Gun, it would have worked. Yeah. Because that formula has continued to work in every form of media that features one hotshot, one guy who's humble but skilled, and then, you know, the commanding officer that's got to deal with the both of them. Like, that's it. But the fact is that we've got to deal with Raleigh and the extremely fucking brutal death of his brother, and which, goddamn, that was fucking brutal. but then we've got to deal with, you know, Dickie McShitcunt Australian. And his dad, who's just like, I'm really sorry. It's like, don't be really sorry. Why is he behind the wheel? He was like, fucking shit.
Love the fact that he doesn't even, like, he lost that fight badly. I mean, he got his ass humbled. It was, like, there's this one shot where he lands against the steam pipe, and then the steam is released, and he gets this look. It's like, oh, wow, visual metaphor. He's getting really steamed.
Yeah. I did like the fight between Dickie and Raleigh, though. Like, I applaud Del Toro for actually taking the Dick Pilot meme of these types of films and just deciding that the Dick Pilot shouldn't win the fist fight because Raleigh clearly kicked his fucking ass. Yeah. And he landed like almost no punches in that fight.
And again, sort of the problem with my problem with that is everything was just just too easy for Raleigh, you know? There was never any tension there. He got over the death easily. He got back in the game easily. He won the fight easily.
Well, if Idris Elba went up to you and was like, take this knife, put it in your ass, swirl it around until you shit salsa. Like, yes, Mr. Idris Elba, sir. I'm doing this for you.
I wouldn't even let him get to the end of the sentence. I would be down on that bad boy.
Immediately. Like, yeah, it's really about, you know, it's the type of actor that sells the sort of that sells the scenario. So if it was
he's a real Liam Neeson kind of actor, you know, like you know, Liam is one of those guys that can also make some really terrible dialogue just sing.
No, like, actually, look no further, as far as that, look no further than Taken. Because outside of that speech, holy shit, that was a terrible movie.
Yeah, it's really just Liam Neeson breaking people's arms for a whole movie.
Well, it's a very, you know, it caters to a very, very base instinct. You know, and I think as far as those films can be cathartic, they deserve to exist in that way. But yeah, I mean, they definitely don't cater to good side of humanity.
More than any other film I've ever seen, probably in the last 5 years, this movie sports some of the pussiest, most absolute shit-stained politicians in a movie I've ever seen in my life. Actually, yeah, beyond those 5 years, I've never seen a more spineless group of movie politicians than in Pacific Rim.
The whole politician scene was just like, hey, America, pay attention. Building a wall. We're going to build a wall. Building a wall works. Building a wall doesn't work.
Doesn't work. It's the best option we got. Motherfucker, you got these gigantic robots that admittedly are on their last legs. But yeah, your solution is something that is proven to not work.
Mm. I mean, just the whole how they focused on that scene of the kaiju just like walking through the wall like it wasn't even there. Del Toro just laughing his ass off like Viva la Mexico, yeah. You know.
it's such a summer blockbuster thing. Like some blockbuster message to send though. Defense? Fuck defense. Let's just hit something till it breaks.
Punch it in the face. Punch it in the face.
The best defense is a whole lot of bullets. Which,
like, even the secretive oligarchy behind the Avengers that, you know, Powers Booth was leading for some reason, even those, like, didn't come off as prickish and completely up their own asses like the politicians in Pacific Rim. I mean, and those motherfuckers fired a nuke at New York City. And what do these guys do? It's like, we're defunding the Jaeger program and just hiding behind a gigantic wall and hope for the best.
And then they hide in a bunker. Like, the wall didn't work. We knew it wasn't going to work. So when the kaiju are coming and they're coming in force, it's like, fuck it, we got a bunker. You guys are on your own.
Oh, God. Like, I haven't seen such, like, obvious and played up
anti-American sentiment,
I guess is the word, political anti-American sentiment, then 2012 with that Oliver Platt scene. It's like, you mean people are using their position of authority to their own content?
Honestly, the whole of the setup of the movie from beginning to end, when you ignore the fact that the whole movie really is just Independence Day with giant robots, I didn't like any of the characters, but Idris Elba and Mako, and I think I liked Mako just because she portrayed a genuine, like, that's what a real Japanese girl is like. Hollywood, are we paying attention? Are we paying really fucking close attention to what actual Japanese people are like? Can we take notes?
Not all of them love tentacles.
Like, not all of them love tentacles. Not all of them are fucking sex bots. Not all of them are fucking crazy. Just, like, some of them are just regular fucking people who deal with their goddamn lives.
And she was quite the trooper while they were filming the pilot scenes, too, because, you know, you can imagine being in all those suits is pretty tough. And everyone broke down except for Rinko, that's her name. And when Del Toro asked her what her secret was, you know what she said? I think of gummy bears and butterflies.
Oh, that's adorable.
That's just perfect, isn't it?
And supposedly, yeah, she's like a B-tier actress in Japan. Like, she's not even A material. Like, that's what her career isn't exactly like on the top of the fucking food chain.
I mean, she's not like the equivalent of David Hasselhoff in Germany.
Yeah.
The first time I was became aware of her, she's the deaf girl in Babel, is she not? The, you know, the Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett Manchu kind of movie.
Can we get a round of applause to Lachlan Huddy for remembering, of all things, Babel?
I was forced to watch it twice.
Like, my manliness is not in question here.
I'm Australian, mate. I enjoyed how the father's first line had the word mate in it too. It's like, just in case you don't get it, this guy's Australian.
Just hitting you with the big book of Australia.
He says mate.
Yep, he says mate and Paul Hogan.
If only it said fair dinkum, that would have been perfect.
But they didn't say no worries. No worries was nowhere in the film.
Yeah, but No Worries has kind of been co-opted by people from California, so it's not really that exclusively Australian anymore.
If you said too easy, then...
Yeah, too easy, man. Or don't come the raw prawn. That would have been perfect. Like, I don't even really know how that apparently that means, like, just don't lie to me. Like, don't have me on.
How does that make any fucking sense?
It's fine. Nothing makes sense. Although, what does make sense is he's got a couple of roos loose in the top paddock, which I think is fabulous, which essentially just means he's got a screw loose. But if you break it down, it works on so many levels. Because roo, obviously, is short for kangaroo. Paddock is like a field. And top paddock is like your head. And it also kind of rhymes with screw loose. So that's my new favorite Australian slang right there.
Have you used it? Take that away, kids.
What is that, Cockney slang?
No.
It's called Australian strine. It comes out of Cockney rhyming slang. There's a lot of crossover there.
Have you used this phrase yet? Should I be afraid of this phrase?
It's got a couple of... Oh, yes, absolutely. I actually used it in the Australian episode of Bad Call a couple of weeks ago. And I don't think... But I got quite a few complaints about people not being able to understand anything I was saying.
Well, that's what you need. You need, like, a completely unintelligible episode. Like, in the style of A Bit of Fry and Laurie when they did it. When they just had this completely unintelligible, like... soap opera episode where pretty much all you could glean was Bruce and I don't know, mate, but you're buying. It's like, oh, good.
And even in that little chunk of Australian accent you did then was still much better than either of those two guys.
Well, I'm still working on it. You're my Australian dialogue coach at this point.
Just soak it up. Just listen to me and soak it up. Although I have been, my accent is quite broad. Apparently, went to Ireland and I couldn't understand these Irish country people either, but they couldn't understand me because apparently my Australian accent's too broad. So there you go.
Here we go for the first time. How to speak Australian with an actual Australian. Go ahead.
Just try to be as lazy as possible. Like, if you can shorten a word to its real, just like its single component parts, do that. Like, don't say going, you say gan. Hey, gan. You know, good on you, man. And don't say it's me, just say Smee.
Smee. Like, you're talking about Captain Hook's first man.
Yeah, that guy.
I remember the first time that that Bennett tried to do an Australian accent, and it was just awful.
the line in Anime Abandon, like, well, Andy, what I'm going to do is stalk you good here with this waltzing Matilda, you banana bender.
And it's still awful.
You know you're doing a bad British accent there, right? So this is what I'm talking about.
We need fundraisers. but unfortunately, everyone's too lazy.
Dingoes and didgeridoos.
That sort of sounded like a Trey Parker kind of Australian accent. And the only Australian accent worse than South Park is The Simpsons, like, hands down. Worst Australian accent possible. But I think they just kind of go out of their way to do a bad one. So, I'm willing to accept that.
I want to call them Chaz horses.
We promise from now on that if there are any Australian jokes in Anime Abandoned, that Locke will be consulted.
Yeah. So, yeah, down under consultant over here. And I only charge $1,600 an hour.
Fantastic. Fill up the tip jar.
But don't worry, the US dollar is quite strong against the Aussie dollar again now, so you guys will be fine.
Yeah, by like 30 whole cents.
Have we exhausted Pacific Rim, do you think?
I think we've exhausted Pacific Rim, but I do want you to talk about Bad Call TV, because you're here, and I have no idea when we'll be able to get you again, so.
No, we should do it again sometime. Will you just let me know, Mark? I just do what I'm told. People out there in Ben the Sage land, Mark is my marketing guy, so I just do what he tells me, because he seems to know what he's talking about. Which is a horrifying thought, if you know anything about Mark.
That's right. Keep going. The engineer is the overlord that just bends everybody over his knee. You, Bennett, Spoony.
To your iron will. But no, we're on hiatus now because I was over in Europe on my honeymoon. And we didn't film quite enough to cover the gap. And it would be nice if Darcy, who ostensibly is my second in command, could have sort of, brought up the slack while I was away. But if you know anything about Darcy, you know that was never going to happen.
Now, Darcy, he's your second in command.
Well, you know, it's I don't pretend to be able to find good help then. So Darcy can handle unsupervised. Darcy can handle selling houses and getting shit faced. But anything else, forget about it, pal. You got a hold of this little guy's hand. Because the thing about our buddy Darcy, he's an idiot. Now we love him. He's a perfectly benign idiot, but an idiot is what he is. So we will be back. We'll be back this Thursday, your Wednesday in the States, with the new episodes. But we've also been working very hard on some new videos, some really, really off the chain kind of Nerf videos that we're probably going to start releasing early next year, because I still have quite a lot to shoot, and they're quite ambitious. And I'm really looking forward to showing everybody that. But that's going to be on a new website, on a new channel, to kind of open up the kinds of videos we can make and really start getting a bit of variety in there. Because Bad Call, while I love it, and while it's been something that's introduced me to a lot of great people and gotten us a small but very loyal audience, it's very, it's a formula and it's very constrictive, and it's time to start doing doing other things as well as Bad Call. So that's where we're at up to this point now. And it's been, it's been a hell of a ride so far. And, now we're on Ben the Sage. It's great. I just get to be the creepy Cenobite-like demon in Bennett's punishment puzzle box.
Yeah, we gotta find more shit for you to do. Like, I honestly want to find something for Darce to do, but I've resolved this. The next time that we have something to film where it's like, oh yeah, that would be really great if we could get Locke in on this, is that we're gonna have Renee do something that involves her being fully clothed.
Well, you could do that, but I mean, no one wants that, man. I don't think even Renee wants that.
I mean, you're her husband, and you're the least. You want that the least.
Well, all right. Like my opinion on it.
Hey, man. If you got it, flaunt it. I don't mind showing off. Man, I spent a long time as a virgin. Okay. I just kind of lucked into a pretty attractive life partner, and I want people to know this.
That you have a smoking hot wife.
She does do up very well.
See, my whole thing is that I call her the trooper, because it takes a beautiful, strong, and perfectly secure woman to be approached by her husband and say, all right, we're going to have you in a sexy ninja outfit today, and we're going to film it and put it on the internet with your first and last name.
I think... But let's be honest, Mark, that sexy ninja outfit, as sexy as it was, is, let's be honest, probably the most clothing that I've had Renee in any one episode where she's not actually just playing a normal woman. Like, I think I had her in normal clothes just once in the Twilight episode. Yeah. But I thought the sexy ninja outfit covered up quite a lot.
Like, this, you know, this was not as advertised.
Relatively speaking.
I do not want to get shanked by this ninja. Not at all. Not as advertised, money back now.
So I'm really happy with that episode. I thought you and Caitlin did such great.
You called her Caitlin.
I corrected myself. Sorry, Caitlin. Sorry, Miles girl. You were wonderful, by the way. Thank you very much.
She gets it all the time. She don't care. but yeah, I want to get more people around for the shed, because elsewise it's just Bennett and I doing, you know, the back and forth thing. And every once in a while we need to, you know, kind of throw a wrench into it and see what someone else would have to say to us. So I'm happy that you were able to do this.
Well, you know, always let me know. I'm happy to do it. It's a good mix up for me too. I think we need to do something with the Virgin Fleet DVD, because that feels unfinished to me. So, I think, people are waiting for it. I get, you know, I've gotten messages. So what are you going to do with the Virgin Fleet DVD?
Well, as we now all know, violence is coming.
Yes.
violence is coming, and Locke has a part in violence coming, and you won't know until much, much, much later.
I think that was the first thing we did together, wasn't it?
As soon as the idea came about. That was absolutely, because this idea has been, this idea is like 8 months old now.
Yeah, we shot it ages ago, and it's still got quite a bit to come. I mean, we shot it so long ago, that was when I still had the long locks.
Yeah, but there's a whole lot more. So pretty much, if we had to look at it, that you're the villain of the Bennyverse.
And I'm okay with it.
I wouldn't call him the villain. Just like you're kind of like you're my Newman, basically.
Sometimes like good, sometimes bad.
Sometimes good. I mean, like, in my Bennett Takes Over the World galaxy-destroying universe, you're basically a Cenobite that runs my punishment cube. And
with
by the
my,
way, I want
to... my silky pants again.
Oh.
By the way, before I want to get this recorded, I got a message about the t-shirt promo, and it was on Twitter, and it was simply just, "Really, Bennett, a gay German?" And I told him very quickly, like, sex has nothing to do with the punishment cube.
You only perceive that sex has something to do with the punishment cube, but it's something far, far worse.
Also, frankly, and this is probably exposing just how sad I am, but the backstory for this character, I mean, you couldn't lock him down to something so prosaic as gay. I mean, he's obviously fucking everybody, you know? Like, I don't think this guy draws any lines.
No, he punches out, goes home, and does the exact same thing that he does at work. Like, that's...
Yeah. He doesn't like to keep work at work. You know, he's kind of like the Pope that way.
Yeah, he just...
There is no such thing as downtime.
And your direction for that scene was get your rape face on. Which, of all the men I've known, you have the single most creepy fucking rape face
We don't know if it's the makeup or the contact lenses.
No, it's not. It's not the makeup. It's not the contact lenses. It's not the lighting, which Locke did a great job on.
Didn't it come out well? I'm really happy with
it. It was really fucking good. It's not Jeff. It's not even the fact that your shirt's off. It's your smile.
It is a creepy. It's, you know, it's this combination of the smile, and when I tip my head down, you see the hookishness of my nose, and I think those two things together. Yes, they really sell it. They really sell the creepiness.
Single fucking creepiest rape face I've ever seen. And of course, you can see it front page on BadCallTV.com. Welcome to Bad Call TV. Drop them.
Welcome to Bad Call TV. You will not be walking straight.
you ain't doing shit right for a month.
And on that bombshell, this has been a marathon of a podcast. I'd like to thank our good friend Lachlan Huddy of BadCallTV.com. Visit it at your leisure.
Thank you, gents.
Thank you for joining us, and peace out.